This is Clinical Conversations podcast number 133. Thank you for joining us. We're part of Journal Watch, which tracks new research for working clinicians. Its website is jwatch.org. I'm Joe Elia. Joining me is co-host Dr. Danielle Schurer of the Medical University of South Carolina. In 1971, some 40 years ago, the New England Journal of Medicine published an article examining the possible causes of an unusual cluster of clear cell adenocarcinomas of the vagina in young women. The cluster had itself been reported a year earlier in Cancer. As is well known now, the mothers of the young women had almost all received diethylstilbestrol, DES, in the first trimester of their pregnancy. This week, the New England Journal published a follow-up on a cohort of some 4,600 women exposed to DES in utero, comparing them with unexposed controls. The researchers measured the DES daughters' risks of adverse reproductive outcomes to age 45 and other outcomes to age 55. Two authors of the new paper, Dr. Robert Hoover and Dr. Kenneth Noller, are our guests today. Dr. Hoover is director of the Epidemiology and Biostatistics Program at the National Cancer Institute, and Dr. Noller is a past president of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and is now with the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology. Welcome, Dr. Hoover and Dr. Noller.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can you describe briefly how you found these women and kept track of their reproductive health over the years?
This is Dr. Hoover. The initial studies were started in the 1970s after the report of vaginal adenocarcinoma, and the particular study we're reporting on now refers to three separate studies that were begun then. One was the follow-up of a randomized clinical trial of DES, which had been performed in the early 1950s at the University of Chicago. The other was a very large multi-center study of patients who had been women who had been exposed and their offspring, which was funded by the National Cancer Institute and enrolled women who had documented evidence of exposure, and as a comparison group of women who had documented that they had not been exposed. And the third was started as a cohort of DES mothers to determine if any adverse effects had occurred in them, and in the early 1990s, a group of their daughters was contacted and invited to participate in this combined cohort. So these three cohorts had been followed systematically until the mid to late 1980s, and then in the early 1990s, they were put together by the investigators involved into one large cohort and have been followed systematically since that time.
Do you follow a wide range of possible outcomes, ranging anywhere from female cancers to infertility and other pregnancy complications? And what you found was, you know, all these rates were higher in the DES-exposed groups with the highest excess risk, primarily for preterm delivery and infertility. And, you know, in some ways, has this in utero exposure precluded normal reproduction?
To this Bob Hoover again. Yep. Fairly much so. It was sort of impressive the proportion of the population that was affected. Basically, as you mentioned, that compared to a 15% infertility rate in the unexposed, there were 33% in the exposed. And with women who were successful in getting pregnant, there was a spontaneous abortion rate of 50% compared to the 38% in the unexposed. And for women who were able to bring a baby into the third trimester, the lifetime or reproductive lifetime prevalence of having a preterm birth was 53% compared to 17. So it was a fairly devastating exposure for a wide variety of outcomes. And I don't know, Dr. Noller may have a comment on that as well.
Yeah, this is Ken Noller. I had the opportunity to take care of a large number of these women, about 1,000 of them over the years. And one of the things that I had to keep reminding them was that about two-thirds of them would have no problems whatsoever, and about a third would have really quite significant problems, as Bob just mentioned.
It's really, it's just, it, I can imagine it was just terribly hard to share that news with a large number of women. The other interesting aspect of this follow-up was this connection between the presence of early vaginal epithelial changes and the heightened risk for these adverse effects. Can you talk a little bit more about that as well?
Vaginal epithelial changes is kind of a funny term we coined. A lot of the DES women are more familiar with the term adenosis, which just means glandular tissue in the vagina. But in fact, the abnormalities included some squamous abnormalities, so it's sort of just different tissue in the vagina than should be there. And those women that had those changes were more likely to have any of the abnormalities than women who didn't. The biggest problem, though, now is that most of those changes have disappeared as the women have aged, so you can't look for those and predict. If a woman knows she had those changes, then her risk now for such things as breast cancer would be heightened.
Two other populations that I'm just curious if we know anything about. One is, do we know anything about the grandchildren of mothers exposed to DES? And the second is, do we know if there's any untoward effects in males that we know of?
This is Bob Hoover again. I'll do the grandchild one, and I'll let Ken do the sons. While we were conducting this combined follow-up, the laboratory investigators, particularly Aretha Knobold at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, was doing a lot of laboratory animal work and actually uncovered the fact that in laboratory animals, this exposure does, in fact, cause problems in the so-called third generation and the granddaughters. Primarily, it looks like, because it's actually affecting programming, the methylation of the DNA in the ova of the fetus that was exposed, and it results in an excess risk in animals of endometrial or uterine and ovarian cancers. So there's a lot of interest in following up these daughters now. We have used the combined cohort to ask the daughters who are in our follow-up study if we could contact their daughters and invite them. And we're in the process of doing that. We only have several hundred right now, and so I'm not sure we're going to have the power to, statistical power to investigate it thoroughly, although there is some evidence from our first questionnaire that they have some excess of history of infertility, very kind of similar to the percent that their mothers had. But and I know Dr. Knoller in his past life was at the Mayo Clinic, which actually had the biggest set of DES sons followed up, and they have been incorporated in this too. Do you want to talk about that, Ken?
Sure, I'd be happy to, Bob. Unlike the women, where there's just no doubt that there have been some abnormalities, the literature on men is quite mixed. Some of the studies have found no abnormalities whatsoever. Some have found significant abnormalities, and some others have sort of been in between. Well, maybe there's a problem, maybe there isn't. It was thought for a while there'd be infertility problems, but those really don't seem to be prominent. Some question about a slight increased risk of testicular cancer, but the cohorts beyond the age group where that tends to, they tend to be affected. So the men really aren't all that clear.
It's so disappointing. I mean, here you are, you know, three generations later, and you still might be finding abnormalities. I mean, it's really astounding.
It is. This is Bob Hoover again. It is quite astounding. This was kind of the first time we had actually developed these cumulative estimates of risk of how much actual disease or adverse events had happened by the time these women got to the end of their reproductive lives or into age 55. And actually the numbers stunned me too, even though we had been studying this ourselves for quite some time.
And especially for a drug that would seem to be so innocuous. I mean, I'm sure at the time it never really crossed people's minds that this could possibly be so harmful.
That's correct. There was some evidence from the laboratory back in the very early 1940s that high doses of estrogen in pregnancy might increase progesterone and therefore help prevent preterm births. And as it turns out, the measure of progesterone turned out to be not measuring progesterone, so actually even that particular fact was wrong. But as you say, I think there was a general impression that gee, there's so much estrogen floating around in a pregnant woman anyway, a little bit more isn't going to make any difference. And it was certainly given in good faith. That unfortunately, it was started about 5 or 6 years before the concept of a randomized clinical trial, as we know it today, was invented. And so it sort of got popular before it actually got tested.
Your co-author, Dr. Arthur Herbst, he's the author of the 1971 paper, or co-author, isn't he?
Correct.
Yeah. And I was thinking about the unlikelihood of this was a very small signal that was seen in these women. There was a cluster of cases. I guess you could say it was found by pathologists. And these clear cell adenocarcinomas were unusual, but it was Herbst and others, and I don't mean to denigrate anyone else's role, but it was he and a small group who said, what's behind this? The likelihood that might happen today, or that it would even happen then, is pretty small, I guess. Would you say?
Bob Hoover again. I guess, yeah, it was... It certainly was extraordinarily unusual to see this tumor, which when it does occur, occurs in very old women, and even then is not very common. To see a cluster of cases with this in teenagers was kind of stunning, and you are correct, Dr. Altfelder and Dr. Herbst. It's a great example of what's known as the alert clinician, a clinician that sees a really unusual event and manages to think more than just about therapy, but about trying to figure out what's going on. And also a great example of an alert mother, because it was a mother that suggested this to them, and they picked up on it really quickly.
Wow.
and followed up on it to confirm it. There is kind of a lesson here as well, though, that's, I think, for particularly apt currently, that it's really a very strong advertisement for the need for post-marketing surveillance. If there hadn't been this really unusual tumor occurring in a really unusual group, we would never know all of the adverse effects that are sort of documented in this paper. If it just never would have raised any suspicion. A woman comes in and has a preterm birth, nobody would have said, gee, I wonder what she was exposed to when she was in utero. So I think that's a really powerful lesson that we don't know how many of these drugs were given and don't have the so-called advantage, maybe, of having a really unusual event to call attention to them, but by systematic follow-up, as has gone on in this cohort, would be uncovered. I think that's a very powerful lesson right now.
The fact that there are millions of people exposed in utero to DES who are out there, many of them now among the baby boom generation, most of them among the baby boom generation, so they're coming into clinicians' offices more and more often. Not necessarily obstetricians and to see obstetricians and gynecologists. What would you advise the general primary care clinician to be aware of with these patients, and what's possible? What kinds of conversation is possible to determine someone's risk?
I'll pump that one to the one who's had all these conversations.
Ken. Well, this is Ken again. For those women who know that they're exposed, they usually do bring it up. And now, since most of them are beyond childbearing age, the main concern at the present time is breast cancer, and they certainly need to be followed for breast cancer with a regular screening. A clinician who is very astute might ask women about their mother's histories of miscarriage, or did your mother ever say that she took drugs when she was pregnant with you? Because they're probably not going to be able to find anything on physical examination. Likewise, the woman who herself says that she's had several miscarriages or was infertile, You might be suspicious, though, among all infertile women, only a tiny subset of them were DES exposed because infertility is so common. So it's rather tough if you don't know the history.
This is Bob again. I think it would also be, I would encourage clinicians, if they do, or if the woman or son, for that matter, knows that they were exposed, to be alert, because we're still wondering if there are other things that are going to occur. There are a number of hormonally related chronic conditions that don't show up until the age at which this cohort is now gained. That includes heart disease and osteoporosis and a variety of other things. We're continuing to follow the cohort to see if anything else shows up, and it would certainly be useful to have a cadre of alert clinicians like Dr. Herbst and Ulfelder out there keeping their eyes out also.
All right. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today, Dr. Hoover and Dr. Noller.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thanks so much.
That was our 133rd edition. Sorry for some of the signal problems that we had on the telephones, but that's what we do. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Ador Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time, please. For myself and Dr. Danielle Scherer, thank you for listening.